Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we mark 10 years of Sidetrack. This time around, we're going back and re-airing some of our favorite stories and interviews from the last decade. We'll find out if Philo really is the center of the universe, talk to the inventor of the popcorn fork, revisit our story on the Viper, the yodeling ukulele player, and hear about downtown Champaign's drinking fraternity. We'll have those stories and more this time on Sidetrack. One thing we've always tried to do on Sidetrack is search out those people who were doing interesting, if not unusual, things. Back in August 1999, I profiled a local musician who called himself the Viper. His claim to fame was that he was a yodeling ukulele player, but to call him just a yodeling ukulele player would be doing him a disservice. Here now, from our first year, the story of the Viper and his famous orchestra.
Hello. Yes, this is the Viper and his famous orchestra. Inviting you to come along with us, share a smile and a song with us.
Well, my name's Ryan Jerving. I'm better known as the Viper, and I play ukulele with the Viper and his famous orchestra. I'm the best yodeling ukulele player in downstate Illinois. Maybe even all of Illinois.
Making love, ukulele style. You needn't be in Waikiki. Making love.
It isn't known just how many yodeling ukulele players there are in the area, but the Viper is definitely a unique musical experience. When you hear the Viper and his famous orchestra, you get the strange feeling that you've stepped back in time without leaving the current era. It's Tin Pan Alley tunes with a distinctly modern sensibility. The Viper explains how his act came to be.
I mean, I don't know. I guess I trace it all. I checked out... An Al Jolson and a Fats Waller record the same week when I was, you know, a sophomore as an undergraduate or something, and it sort of all comes from that. The ukulele I started playing around that time. Yodeling I'd actually done a little bit before. I learned that from my mom, who learned it from some old guy that she worked with in a cheese factory in Sheboygan County, Wisconsin.
If Sheboygan calls or Sheboygan falls, it couldn't happen to a nicer year. If I told, I told you that I love, love you, would you be my I know why by the Winnebago Bay?
I'd like to get better at the yodeling. It takes a lot of work, actually. It's like opera singing. You know, you actually have to train your throat, the muscles and all that kind of thing. But I'm working on it. Normally singers, good trained singers, will try to go and mask the break. But if you're a yodeler, you want to actually have it accented. So you go, So, and then you can just start by actually saying the word yodelahe. That's like the one everyone knows. And you just go, yodelahe. You can also try and do like this wolf sound that seems to help you develop the muscle. If you just go, oh, ooh, oh, ooh, oh, ooh.
Besides Tin Pan Alley standards, the Viper's music also includes early jazz, ragtime, swing, old-time country, mambos, cha-chas, and more, as well as modern rock and pop tunes done in a classic style. But the music is more than just a hobby for Jerving. He's currently working on his PhD from the University of Illinois. His dissertation is on jazz and literature in the 1920s and 30s, a subject where his musical knowledge comes in handy. In fact, he's been known to present papers at conferences with ukulele in hand. Sometimes you can find the Viper playing solo, but most of the time he's accompanied by his band, the orchestra part of the Viper and his famous orchestra. Jerving explains the band's lineup.
We have a bass, stand-up bass player, a suitcase player who plays with brushes on a suitcase, which is what a band called the Spirits of Rhythm did in the 30s, and other sort of street musician kind of bands, and then a trombonist. So the unusual, I think, combination of the four things tends to make things have sort of a consistent sound, even though we're playing from a lot of different periods and genres.
Suitcase player Ed Birch, a veteran of rock bands, explains how he made the transition to this different style of music.
All of us, I think, come from a background of growing up with rock music and pop music and have played in other bands that have that kind of feel. So we know what that's about. So we just bring that into this older music, which really, if you sit and think about it, there's not much difference between this cool older music of the 30s or whatever and the stuff that people are putting out now.
Because of Gerving's vast knowledge of popular songs, both past and present, he tends to base his show on particular themes or genres. This particular show has a bit of the Hawaiian flavor.
So we'll be doing a lot of Hapa Haola Hawaiian stuff, the sort of fake faux, the strictly for the tourist kind of Hawaiian music, Tin Pan Alley Hawaiian.
Will be Kalu. Was only love. Before the night is old, my arms will hold Kalua.
And the best way to describe Gerving is as a cultural archaeologist, always searching out those classic songs and always wanting to share them with modern audiences.
I've got a pretty voracious appetite for music, and a lot of it. A little plug for libraries here. I mean, most of my listening has come from just borrowing things from the public library, where I didn't really have any stake in it, and I could take chances with the kind of music I listen to. And so, I find unusual things. I like obscure songs from obscure movies and things like that.
Even though some might categorize the music he plays as kitsch or camp, Gerving is not offended by this designation because it connects him with the great popular songwriters and performers of the past.
I don't think there's anything particularly dirty about the word novelty. I guess we're not doing Weird Al Yankovic or anything like that. But I'm working, I think, within a tradition that valued doing goofy things. Spike Jonze and Fats Waller and Slim Gaylord and people like that.
I think everyone has to see it once, and then once they see it once, they'll want to see it more.
Bass player Riley Broach.
I mean, that's what I tell everybody when I tell them, come see this, you'll like it, and if you don't like it, I'll pay you back. Just come once. Yeah, just come once, and then you'll want to come all the other times.
For Sidetrack, I'm Jason Croft.
She moves her lips to her fingertips. I feel I'm heaven bound. And when she starts to sway, I have to say, she really moves the grass around. Well, rock, a hula baby, rock. A hula baby got a hula hoop to Honolulu. Well, rock a hula baby of mine. You know, I love to kiss my little hula miss, but I never get the chance. I want to hold her tight with all my might, but all she wants to do is dance. Yes, rock. A hula baby rock, a hula baby got a hula hoot to Honolulu. Well, rock a hula baby of mine. Go, man, go! Thank you, Kabuki Man! Love to kiss my little hula miss, but I never get the chance. I want to hold her tight with all my might, but all she wants to do is dance. Sing it, Ryan Sock. A hula baby rock. A hula baby got a hula hoo to Honolulu. Take it, Ed Rock, a hula baby of mine. I said a rock, a hula baby.
This is Sidetrack. Music has always been an important part of the program. We have featured both performers and those who search out music of the past. Champaign is the home of a Grammy-winning record label, Archaeophone, that prides itself on finding recordings from around 100 years ago and bringing them to a modern audience. In 2007, Jeff Bossert profiled the label and their release of World War I era music.
One of the first World War I protest songs was written by the ordinarily patriotic Irving Berlin. Recorded in 1915 by Henry Burr, "Stay Down Here Where You Belong" has the devil warning his son to stay in hell and avoid the war on earth, because the folks up above don't know right from wrong.
To please their king, they've all gone out to war, and not a one of them knows what he's fighting for. Way up above.
The song is one of 56 recordings on The Great War, a two-disc set on Archaeophone Records. It was actually one of the first collections envisioned by label founders Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy 7 years ago. But Richard says they really didn't know what they were doing.
We'd put out 3 CDs at the time, and we're still trying to find our voice. And so it took us that long to figure out how we wanted to do this.
While compiling 32 more releases the last few years, the husband and wife team continually revisited the approach for a World War I collection. Martin says ideas range from a set of songs the Doughboys sang, profiling the most popular hits among the military, to a history lesson, analyzing a large number of songs from the period and their lyrics.
That was a little too much high school English class. So what we ended up realizing needed to be done, had never been done before, was to tell the story of the industry, the recording industry, the role it played in helping to sell the war. And that was the gold mine.
Martin says many at that time failed to take the phonograph seriously, considering it more of a toy around 1916. That's the year Woodrow Wilson narrowly won the presidential election with a platform of avoiding the war effort. But a year later, he reluctantly committed the U.S. military after negotiations with Germany fell through. Wilson not only enlisted Congress to finance a buildup of troops, but created a campaign of Americanism by starting up a new federal agency to not only promote the war domestically, but to question the loyalty of German immigrants. The Committee for Public Information, or CPI, was basically a propaganda network of public speakers, advertisers, film, and other media. But Director George Creel, an investigative journalist and politician, didn't seek out the recording industry. Record companies responded to the snub by producing a publicity campaign of their own to get troops ready for the trip overseas. Archaeophone's Megan Hennessy.
They recognized very early on that there was so much interest in the war that they should be selling product about it, because people didn't have news like they do now. This was how they got it. And store owners would say, you know, you got to set up a war display. People want to hear it. Whenever I put on the national anthems of countries at war, people come and stand and hang out in my shop. And they realized it was good for business.
A long, lean country gig from Wales, where the hops don't wait. He was 6 feet two and his socks in three.
One recruitment song, released in 1917, used lighthearted humor in an attempt to gain acceptance of the U.S. entry into the war. Long Boy was recorded by Byron G. Harlan with the Peerless Quartet.
Hey, goodbye, Ma, goodbye, Pa, goodbye, Mule, with your old hee-haw. I may not know what the war's about, but you bet by gosh I'll do my best. Hello, my sweetheart, don't you fear, I'll bring you a...
This song has a personal connection for a teacher and record collector who collaborated on the CD project.
That's my grandpa. That's him. He put away the mule, he took care of the cow, and he went downtown and he stood in line with the rest of the draftees and went to war.
Clarence O. Johnson says when he was 4 or 5, his grandfather, Clarence D. Johnson, would sit him on his knee and recall stories of serving in France during the First World War, having been drafted into the Army just weeks after graduating from high school. Johnson says his grandfather didn't achieve any military honors, but for him, it was a matter of doing what the government asked.
To the day of his death, 92, I'm sure he could have told you every step of every day that he spent in the forest. Sometimes couldn't remember what he had for lunch, but he could remember the forest. He told me within 2 weeks of his dying that he still woke up reaching for the dead man in the foxhole.
Johnson, a high school and college English teacher in Dallas, says his studies illuminated what his grandfather was all about before and after the war. Archaeophone's release of The Great War is dedicated to the memory of Clarence D. Johnson. Just prior to 1917 and the U.S. military effort, there were war protest songs that were essentially lost with the message marketed by the government. Megan Hennessy says another selection on their CD set incorporated humor to voice its disapproval of the German occupation of the Western Front.
One of the ones that actually is interesting the more you hear it is War Talk at Pumpkin Center. Cal Stewart did a rural comedy, spoken word routines, and this was set back in the day after the Belgian atrocities were going on, and all the men folk in Pumpkin Center are complaining about the fact that they can't get any sewing done because the women are making clothing for the Belgians. It's really unusual.
I am going around with my pants held up with a tenpenny nail and a clothespin and a flag of truce fluttering from the rear while my wife and gals is sewing for Belgians. I made up a song about it. I'll set down the melodeon, see if I can sing it for you. All the folks at our house are busy as can be, sewing for them Belgians what live across the sea. I've got nothing left to wear, not much between me and the air. If I grumble, they don't care. Gosh, I wish I was a Belgian. Gosh, I wish I was a Belgian.
For the last portion of the Archaeophone release, the recordings begin to reflect the reality of war and the aftermath with soldiers who didn't return home. World War I was labeled the Great War because many believe it was responsible for changing Europe forever. The recording industry began to recognize the impact on the U.S. in the 1920s. Richard Martin describes the very last track on the set, My Dream of the Big Parade, recorded in 1926 by the Peerless Quartet with Billy Murray.
Imagine this dream that the singer is having of seeing a photo play on his wall, and it's this parade of these returning veterans, you know, gassed and wounded, and you know, Gold Star mothers and things like that. And it's very critical, very haunting. And you have the idea then, full circle, that you know, what did we do this for? What was the reason?
Last night I was dreaming of days that are gone, of days that you might recall. And just like a photo play upon my wall, once more I saw it all. It was just a
The Great War, an American musical fantasy, is the first in a new grouping of CDs from Archaeophone called the Critical Issues Series, featuring vintage recordings tied to major historical events. I'm Jeff Bossert.
In my dream of the
big parade,
I saw angels there with the Red Cross there. In my dream of the big parade. I saw Gold Star mothers, sisters and brothers, what a sacrifice they made. I saw one-legged
phantom. You're tuned to Sidetrack. 9 miles south of Urbana is the small town of Philo, population 1,314. Drive too fast down 130 and you just might miss it. But if you slow down and look at their water tower, you'll find something that'll make you rethink your place in the universe. From June 2000, Tom Rogers has more.
Did the universe have to begin somewhere? Does it have a middle, an origin, a center? It might. Say, just above the railroad crossing, about 200 feet up, on the eastern edge of the central business district of Philo, Illinois. Look at their water tower. It'll tell you. So will Philo's former mayor, Gene McCormick.
Like if I go somewhere and they say, where are you from? And I'll say, oh, from Philo. And they'll say, oh, center of the universe. But it's just one of those things that by the radio, power of the radio.
It was a radio personality who coined the term center of the universe for our centerpiece village of 1300, WDWS in Champaign, morning man Stevie J, a native Philan or Philoite or Philonian. According to the town's written history of the term, the family was living in India, and a brother of Stevie J's noted that the town of Batur called itself the center of the universe. Well, he theorized that you could drill a straight line through the center of the earth, straight down from Batur, and wind up in Philo. So the center applies there, too. A few mentions on the morning show led to the slogan on the tower, and it's been there since 1987. Well, being an employee of a famous research university where theories are tested every day, I decided to scientifically question what people in Philo take as fact.
Everywhere in the universe, there is a microwave radiation at about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero.
That's Larry Smarr. He's the outgoing head of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. His main discipline is astrophysics.
Now, why do you care? Because what that tells us is that that was the last signature of what we call the Big Bang, which created the universe. Now, a lot of people figure that that means that there was a center of the explosion, right? And that would be the center of the universe.
Now that we've established that there could be a center of the universe, we have to determine whether it is, in fact, Catty Corner from the Philo Tavern or not.
Well, the thing I love about cosmology is that what we really know is that if you want to be the center of the universe, then you can be. Everybody can be the center of the universe because Everhuis is more or less like every other place if you look at it on the large enough scale. There's no preferred center. So Philo might as well be the center of the universe.
So to say the very least, Philo is definitely in the running, along with anything and everything else in the universe, another galaxy or continent or town or street, water tower, bird, speck of dust, atom, heck, even Sydney.
Yeah, that would work. That would work. I think that's a great...
Does that take away from Philo's cachet, though? I mean,
no.
If everybody can be the center of the universe?
Not really. Not really. I think it'll make most of them happy to know that it's really true. It's not a joke.
But then what if Sydney comes out and says, we're the center of the universe?
They could, I suppose, but I don't think they would...
It might fly,
but I don't think they would do that. I think because, you know, we're in proximity to them, and we have friends there, they have friends here. They wouldn't take that away from us.
They could say we're like 6 miles from the center.
Yeah, they could do that. That's right.
Here's an unsettling point, though. The longer you stand on that corner there in Philo, everything around you, the curb, the water tower, the train, the bar, the bank, the houses, any matter anywhere in the entire universe, is slowly moving away from you, and in turn, from everything else.
Say you went out and looked at, from Philo, you set up a telescope, and you went and looked at a bunch of distant galaxies. What you'd find is, in every direction in the sky you look, they're all running away from Philo, as if you were the center of the universe. Now, it turns out that if you went out to San Francisco, or you went to Mars, or you went to the next galaxy over, the Andromeda Galaxy, and you looked out, you'd see exactly the same thing. Every place looks as if it's the center of the universe. Only a few of them call themselves the center of the universe. Think of it this way. Take a balloon and put little dots of paint equally distant from each other all over the balloon so it's freckled. Okay? And so there's the same distance between all those objects. Now, blow up the balloon slowly. And what happens, of course, as the balloon gets bigger and bigger, the distance between all those spots gets greater and greater and greater, right? Now, sit on one of those spots of paint and look at all the ones everywhere around the balloon. They're all moving away from you. You think you're the center of the universe. But now, go to any other dot of paint, and if you look at it, everything's moving away from you because the space is uniformly expanding under you. It'll be so hard to measure that, you know, it might be a trillionth of an inch, you know, in 100 million years or something. But fundamentally, that's what's going on.
So, enjoy small towns while you can. People in Philo certainly are.
It's just a nice little town with comfortable people and comfortable places to live, and we're just comfortable with each other. A lot of new people have come into town, and I'm sure they probably all think we're nuts.
But not nuts enough to pass up a marketing opportunity. You can buy the Center of the Universe t-shirt, the cap, even the Center of the Universe coverlet at the Philo 125th Anniversary Celebration later this summer. Clever strategy, and such is the way of the universe.
The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
Listening to Sidetrack. Back in 2002, the folks in the small southern Illinois town of Olney celebrated the 100-year anniversary of their famed albino rodent. Former AM580 reporter Allie Kawa was there and got the story of Olney's white squirrels.
It's hard to appreciate just how seriously the town takes its white squirrels.
We've advertised them, protected them, fed them, nursed them. You name it, we've tried to do it.
It's a symbol of Olney, I guess.
Not everybody has them. There's something very unique, and we enjoy seeing them and taking care of them.
That last testimonial is Belinda Hinton. She's the one who organized the anniversary festival, quite possibly the largest celebration of white squirrels to date. Olney's not the only town in the U.S. to boast of white squirrels. In fact, there are at least three others. But people who study these types of things, like the Squirrel Lovers Association, say the town of Olney promotes the squirrels far more than the other towns. They pray for the white squirrels.
That we give thanks to God for the uniqueness that white squirrels have added to the city of Olney, we pray, Lord, hear our prayer.
The police have a white squirrel profile on the arm of their uniforms. They even have a town song about them. After all this hype and hours spent in the town, I had yet to even see one of the albino creatures. So I enlisted the help of Squirrel Lovers President Greg Bassett.
They're going on the ground, right over there.
Oh my gosh.
There you go.
Do you want to try to feed them?
You want to try?
Sure.
Take a peon with you.
Okay.
Yeah. Just hold your fingers. Just
how close should I get?
Let's squat down and call them over to me.
Hey, you. He's not interested.
Just go slowly so you'll move fast.
Yeah. Yay, he did it. I can't believe he's not scared.
Pretty, aren't they? Come here.
The squirrels are remarkably clean. They're pure white with a tail like sponge sugar and little pink eyes. No one knows exactly how they got to Olney. Legend has it they were either left by a traveling circus or set free by a resident who had a couple on display at a local tavern. And experts are baffled as to why the squirrels stay. Various universities, biologists, and state agencies have studied the rodents at Olney and the other towns the white squirrels inhabit, but they can't explain why they're not found more than 2 miles outside town limits. Whatever the reason, they're big business in the small town of Olney.
White squirrels are to Olney what the Eiffel Tower is to Paris. And I know they're very protective of their white squirrels, and they should be for that reason. It is very important to them.
And residents will continue to celebrate them, selling squirrel feeders, houses, buttons, T-shirts, and yard signs, just to name a few. But even lifelong resident and composer Mary Lou Jenkins admits it is possible to go a little overboard.
I wrote the song Willie on his little white squirrel, and I think it's a cute song because Olney is famous for their white squirrels, but they're not my whole life.
They try to protect you, but all of
I'm Allie Kawa.
Squirrels are a lot like human beings. There's bad ones, there's good ones, there's nervous ones, there's friendly ones, there's a couple you need to kill.
Still to come, Bloomsday celebrated, the downtown champagne drinking fraternity, and the popcorn fork. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Over our 10 years, we have talked to many inventors, all who have hoped to stumble over the next million-dollar idea. In March 2001, I talked with Don Softman, a man who wanted to change the way we ate popcorn. He came up with an invention he called the popcorn fork, plastic utensils that would make the popcorn eating experience less messy. When we talked, I asked him to describe the fork and explain how it works.
Well, the purpose of it is to keep your hands from getting dirty with butter and oil from eating popcorn. And you hold it like a pencil. It's about 8 inches long, and you manipulate the three tines with your thumb and your first two fingers. And then you just put it in the popcorn, you apply a little pressure, and then release it in your mouth. It's that simple.
Well, I've got one right here. You can kind of hear it. It's a big, mine is blue. They do come in multicolors.
Yeah, we got six different colors, yeah.
It kind of looks like, almost like chopsticks plus one.
Yeah, it's been called chopsticks for dummies by a couple of my customers. They thought that was kind of a way to describe it.
Well, how did this idea of the popcorn fork come to you?
Well, I was sitting in a movie theater, and I was watching a movie, and I'm eating popcorn, and I had a pile full of napkins on my lap, and I knew I was going to have some stains on my clothing. And I started watching other people, and they were having the same kind of a problem with napkins, and they were wiping their hands on their seats and their clothing and each other. And I thought, wow, we can put a man on the moon, and we've got all these fabulous technical advances, and we're still eating with our hands. So that kind of sparked the idea to try to do something about it. It took me about a year to come up with this particular design. I tried a number of other things, and this seems to be doing the job quite well. And there's, in fact, in the last 6 months, we've sold about 200,000 of these things, so we've got a lot of popcorn pioneers out there.
Well, who are your primary customers for this?
Well, right now it's only available on the web, and I've had the good fortune of some large network TV stations picking it up and using it as a newsworthy item, and then they would publish my popcornfork.com website, and that's where the orders have all come across on the internet so far. And I think there's a pretty big spread of people, from youngsters to oldsters that are using it because it's something everyone can use.
Well, that's very true. But I guess it leads me to my big question is, why does the world need a popcorn fork? You know, you were saying that this came by your own personal experience with messy hands in a movie theater, but, you know, are messy hands really that big of a deal?
Well, probably not. We've been eating with our hands for a lot of years. In fact, the last eating utensil was invented in the 1500s. The fork that we use every day to eat with was on the table for over 200 years before somebody actually started putting food in the mouth. They used to just spear the food out of a common pot, put it on their plate. They didn't want to burn their fingers. Then they would put the fork down and eat with their hands. And in Italy, in the 1500s, someone started putting food in their mouth with it, and it was just a few short years, and everybody was eating with a fork. I suspect it might have been something with hygiene, and germs are an issue. I'm not trying to make this a scare tactic, but I didn't like what I was seeing in theaters and other places. You grab things with your hands and so forth. So I just felt that we really don't have to do this, but it's kind of a want. There's about 9 to 13% of the people that do go to movie theaters that don't buy popcorn because they don't want to put up with the mess.
Well, have you actually seen people
Are people gotten back to you saying that they do take this to movie theaters? And
I've got just oodles of very good testimonials from people telling me how much they like it. And I've had a few people call and say, well, you know, they like their spoon. But those are people that didn't like the mess, obviously, because they're using a spoon. And a few of them said, nah, I'd rather eat with my hands. So I guess it's going to take a while before people catch on, because it's we all belong to the flat world society in some respect, and it takes a little bit of doing to get us a change of habit that's been with us for so long.
Well, I mean, there is a certain visceral pleasure in just digging in with your hands. I mean, people, there are still a lot of foods out there which are primarily eaten by hand, you know, fried chicken and French fries, and popcorn is one of them.
Sure.
I mean, is this something that you just want to eradicate?
No, not necessarily. I think if the popcorn fork serves a purpose for a number of people, I think people will make a decision whether they're going to go on continue to use it, and if it becomes the way to eat food in the future, that would be great with me. But if not, I don't see anything wrong with people eating with their hands occasionally. But the cleanliness thing, you know, for office workers, you're kind of limited to eating with your hands, because then even when you wipe your hands on napkins, you don't get it all off, and your keyboards get dirty. People that are doing hobbyists, I know a number of ladies that do crocheting and knitting and things of this nature that have commented that they really like it. And, of course, nurses in hospitals, they're very sensitive to touching things and putting things in their mouth. They seem to like it a lot.
You sent me a bunch of these,
mm-hmm.
and I passed them out to various members here at the radio station. And just today, somebody came by with a bag of popcorn and, you know, put the thing in there. And it's like, you know, this is good, but I can't get that many popcorn kernels in my mouth, you know, as per when I use my hands.
Uh-huh.
It kind of slows them down.
I hear that quite a bit, too.
You do?
Yeah. I think a lot of people say, well, I'm a two-fisted eater. I got to stuff my mouth full. Well, the reality is you can only get so much in your mouth. And after a little practice with this, you're going to be able to pick up 6 to 8. Some people pick up 10 pieces of corn, which is it's a mouthful. You can only chew it and swallow it so fast. So if you make 2 trips to the bowl with a popcorn fork or 1 with your hand, there's a trade-off there.
Well, are you thinking about making a supersized, a gigantic popcorn fork?
Well, maybe something to mount on top of my car for advertisement. But I think I may go the other direction for the younger children. I have grandchildren that use this quite regularly. In fact, it's become a way of life with them. By the way, I had this thing for 9 years now, or actually 10 years. 10 years ago, I invented it. But I had some other inventions, and I just kind of shelved this one until a year ago. But my family and a number of people that I know have been using it for that many years, and I guess it's just become a way of eating. I asked a couple of them, and they said, well, they wouldn't think of eating mashed potatoes and gravy with their hands anymore than eating popcorn without the popcorn fork. So that's encouraging.
That was Don Sothman, inventor of the popcorn fork. We talked back in 2001. You're tuned to Sidetrack. Every June 16th, fans of James Joyce get together to celebrate his novel Ulysses. It's called Bloomsday, named after the character Leopold Bloom, and the day in question is the day in 1904 when the novel takes place. In 2004, Jim Meadows followed the day-long festivities throughout downtown Champaign.
It's 8:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, June 19th. The actual Bloomsday was 3 days earlier. But this is the weekend, and at the Verde Art Gallery in downtown Champaign, a Bloomsday celebration is getting started. Edward Wewell is the first person to show up. He's already gone through Ulysses once in his lifetime, listening to the entire book on tape while driving.
Well, I don't know. I just find it interesting, and it all takes place in one day. It's kind of fascinating that you could put so much in there, and it's pretty risque, I guess, for the time.
In all, about a dozen people are on hand to listen to David Garrick, one of the local Bloomsday organizers, read from the first chapter of the novel, which opens on the morning of June 16th, 1904.
Chapter 1, Telemachus. Stately
Plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown ungirdled.
James Joyce started his novel Ulysses in an ordinary way on an ordinary day in Dublin. In the course of 18 chapters, Jewish ad salesman Leopold Bloom travels around the city of Dublin, sometimes in the company of the young tortured intellectual Stephen Dedalus, finally ending his day in bed with his wife Molly. That Bloom's journey has a parallel with the journey of Ulysses in Homer's Odyssey is just part of what's fascinated and frustrated readers for more than 80 years. There's also a wide range of literary styles, stream-of-consciousness writing, and risque passages that led Ulysses to be banned in America for 12 years. For Gehrig, who has read through Ulysses three times, it's all part of the fun.
The book is extremely rewarding in that the energy you give it is given back to you five times over. Any effort you make in trying to sort of decode some of the more inscrutable parts, you discover every time that Joyce did have something that he was trying to do here, that there was something meaningful, maybe a little disguised, but something significant.
But Bloom's day is as much an occasion for music and revelry as it is for literary appreciation. Champaign-Urbana's Bloom's Day Centennial featured Irish music throughout the day at various bars and coffee shops. In the outdoor sidewalk cafe of the Cowboy Monkey, members of the local Irish folk group Banish Misfortune played under the billing of Lenehan's Riddle, a reference to an anecdote in Joyce's novel.
And then she rose and let him in and kissed his ruby lips and chin. Then they went to bed again, the soldier had won her favor. Then she blessed the rainy night, go blow on a rainy night. Then she blessed the rainy night, that ever she lets him in.
At another nearby bar, Bentley's, lovers of Irish music gathered for Paddy Diggum's wake, a reference to a wake held in Ulysses, and some informal music making.
Road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road, and all the way to Dublin, what follow there are. From there I got away, me spirits never fail.
The singer is Lisa Boucher, a local musician, and with Gehrig, the co-organizer of Champaign-Urbana Bloomsday. They started putting together Bloomsday celebrations in 2002. Boucher says she likes Joyce's novel for the rhythm and pulse of its language. She says she just plowed through the parts she didn't understand, and she hopes others who came to Bloomsday events will do the same.
Actually, I've talked to several people that have just decided that they're going to, or they have just started reading it because they heard this was coming up and found out that they're actually enjoying it. It's a really funny book. It's hilarious. I think that anybody can read it if they just dare to read it. I dare you. I dare you to read Ulysses.
Ulysses was read all day during Champaign-Urbana Bloomsday. Starting with that 8:30 a.m. reading from the book's first chapter, the readings continued at various places around downtown Champaign. One of the readings was on the air. Over at the Market Street studios of WEFT Radio, Gehrig joined Carl Estabrook on his arts program from Bard Diverse. Together they read from the chapter known as Ithaca, where Leopold Bloom and the young Stephen Dedalus arrive at Bloom's home. Joyce uses the question and answer format of a catechism to describe, often in extreme detail, the late night events.
What action did Bloom make on their arrival at their destination?
At the house steps of the fourth of the equidifferent uneven numbers, number 7 Eccles Street, he inserted his hand mechanically into the back pocket of his trousers to obtain his latchkey. Was it there?
It was in the corresponding pocket of the trousers which he had worn on the day but one preceding. Why was he doubly irritated?
Because he had forgotten, and because he remembered that he had reminded himself twice not to forget. What were then the alternatives before...
Estabrook, who read Ulysses in college, says he finds a madness in the book that makes him wonder about James Joyce's sanity. In fact, Estabrook thinks Joyce was half nuts, and he thinks the author's mental instability contributed to his writing.
I think what he does is take all of that madness and his substantial learning. I mean, he does have a remarkable range of association, and put it together with all his anxieties as glue, and the result is this amazing Gaudi-like cathedral that's Ulysses.
At the Great Imposter Restaurant, Mike Healy and WILL-FM's Roger Cooper read from the chapter known as Sirens, in which the parallel to the sirens that taunted Ulysses and Homer are two barmaids who taunt the main character in Joyce's Ulysses, Leopold Bloom.
Married to the greasy nose,
she yelled.
Shrill with deep laughter, after gold, after bronze, they urged each other to each to peel after peel, ringing in changes, bronze, gold, gold, bronze, shrill deep, to laughter after laughter, and then laughed more.
Greasy, I knows.
Exhausted,
breathless.
Their shaken heads they laid, braided and pinnacled by glossy combed against the counter ledge, all flushed,
oh,
panting, sweating,
oh,
all breathless.
Married to Bloom, to Grease Bloom.
Shelley Cordulac of Champaign is part of the group listening to the reading. Her experience with Ulysses, like those of many others, harkens back to college. She says her enjoyment of Joyce's novel isn't dependent on actually understanding it all.
I think in some ways, Ulysses, you can pick up at any point and just enjoy the rhythm of the words. And obviously, it's an intimidating and an ultimate book for many people, and they realize it, and it's so encompassing. But on the other hand, it can be done in bits, too, and enjoyed from that point of view.
But if you needed some help with Ulysses, there was the half-hour whirlwind tour at Mike and Molly's Irish Pub to explain it all. David Gehrig and Dave Librick went through the book chapter by chapter, reading brief excerpts and keeping an irreverent scorecard of events.
One long gone, one feels that one is at one with one who
wants... That's really enough, Stephen. That's just enough. Okay, end of chapter 3. Has Bloom met Stephen? No. Has Molly cheated on her husband? Not yet. Has Leopold paid for the lemon soap? No. Has Stephen bathed yet? Well, let's see. Is it October? No, it's still June. Why did Molly marry Leopold anyway? We don't know. Chapter 4, Calypso. We finally meet the main
After the whirlwind tour, Champaign-Urbana's Bloom's Day wound down with readings from the final chapter, featuring the sensual soliloquy of Leopold Bloom's
yes.
wife, Molly.
And his heart was going like mad. And yes, I said yes, I will, yes.
By this time of night, chilly temperatures kept the crowd in the beer garden down to just a handful, but a weary David Gehrig announced this year's Bloom's Day a success.
I've only been reading Joyce now for about, 12 hours, 14 hours straight, so... but on the other hand, a whole lot of people have had a chance to participate. It's also nice to see the whole cycle of the story from start to finish. The little epic of the day of Dublin, of Bloom's Day. It's nice to see it in miniature, and it's nice to have had a chance to celebrate it.
As Champaign-Urbana's Bloom's Day centennial celebration came to a close, Gehrig says he was too exhausted to think about next year's celebration. I'm Jim Meadows.
Yale has Skull and Bones, Cornell has the Quill and Dagger, and Champaign has its own invitation-only society, Pi Omega Omega, the downtown drinking fraternity. Selective but not elitist, Pi Omega Omega's members include everyone from dishwashers to graduate students, babies to bar owners. The only common points are a sense of humor, a nickname, and a meeting with the President Moose. From the April 2007 edition of Sidetrack, independent producer Matt Kessler put together this audio postcard.
I would like to say that 98% of this bar has a frat name.
Hi, my name's Mike. My frat name is Hooker. I live in Champaign and I'm a graduate student.
My name is Ryan Double Down Walker.
My name is George, and my frat name is Jungle. We had actually looked up in a dictionary that Jungle is actually from the Swahili Jungala. And so sometimes I go by Jungala.
The youngest frat member ever was named in utero. Babies in utero don't drink.
So much of the stuff is just kind of inside jokes that started between a couple of people in the frat, and nobody else really knows what the inside joke is, but they just kind of pick up on it and run with it. Kind of like chicken.
Six
The frat is Pi Omega Omega.
Pi Omega Omega is P-O-O, or...
poo.
Downtown frat is a mockery of the rather large Greek system at the University of Illinois. At least it started that way, and now it's more of just a nonsensical kind of big, big, huge inside joke that everyone is in on.
The frat is the downtown drinking culture community.
Mostly people who are industry workers, people who work restaurant, bars, things like that, people in the know.
It's a way to figure out who's the insiders and who's the outsiders.
I think that Pi Omega Omega and the word fraternity are usually not used in the same context. They don't really strive to be a quote-unquote fraternity in the sense that most people would associate terms with a fraternity. I think that they would strive to be a fraternity in the actual definition of the word. Like, if you need a shoulder, you got it. If you need a place to crash, you've got it. If something happened today that is really horrible, then, you know, hey, you can tell me about it, and we'll see what we can do to get through this, you know, and a few pints. I think that Pi Omega Omega actually embodies every good aspect of a fraternity.
Champaign, to me, is a college town that would be very uninteresting if not for the college, but at the same time, I personally dislike it revolving completely around the University of Illinois.
A regular frat, if somebody would say fraternity to me, the first thing I would think is a backwards hat, probably a trucker hat, you know, designer clothing, wasted talent with my parents' money sort of organization. The drinking fraternity, on the other hand, I think is more of like a working class, like, you know, it's like a working man's fraternity. Everybody that's in the fraternity has a job, and most of them work well over 40 hours a week.
The frat is very diverse. We've got professionals, we've got dishwashers, and we've got everybody in between. You know, other than the frat itself, there's no, like, single thread that ties everybody together, except that they know our president, Barney, or Moose, I should say.
I was not in on the beginnings of the frat. It started about 10 years ago. Moose was the one of the founders, Moose,
the president of Pi Omega, came in one night after a bout of drinking and socializing with other folks, and told me that he had a dream.
Not that I'm comparing Moose to Buddha, but I must say that he has a very unique sense of humor that I think that we could all benefit from.
I was in his dream. I don't remember what all was happening in the dream, but I didn't know him very well, and he came in hardly able to stand up, walked right up to me and said, "Double Down. You are in my dream. Your name is Double Down."
My name is Moose. It was 10 years ago. It was a roommate and I were just sitting in our room, and basically we were always hanging out with the same people and getting drunk together. It's like, hey, we should give each other nicknames.
There are no assigned rules. There's no, like, assigned study sessions or good behavior monitors or obligated hours towards charity work or anything like that.
There are some official positions. Moose is the president. The vice president does not go out to the bars nearly as often as she did when the frat began.
I am not the best at keeping the rules, but 27 is always a magic number.
St. Jack is the god of drinking and gambling. He was a red-haired Viking with a giant mullet and mustache who had a pet chicken named Sweet Sue.
There's real talk and then there's...
sick talk.
Sick talk. Real talk is frat talk, and sick talk is real talk.
Things like calling their beer their wife, or their smokes their kids, home is jail, and pretty much all the bars in downtown have a frat nickname. Mike and Molly's, for instance, is the counseling center where people get together with their wives.
The brass rail is work, and I 10 bar here 5 days a week, so I was given the official title of Secretary of Labor. A boyfriend or a girlfriend is a drinking problem.
In real talk, you have your wife, which is your beer. So right now, I'm actually married to my wife. And my alcohol problem's downstairs with his wife.
You know, I'd say there's a good couple dozen members of the frat that their frat name is the name they mostly go by.
More often than not, I refer to people by their frat name.
Everybody's welcome. There's no exclusions. You just have to become friends with a couple members of the frat and have them bring you to Moose. And, you know, you have to tell Moose a little bit about yourself, and then he comes up with a frat name.
Sometimes Barney's really drunk, and then he's got a thing in his head, and he goes, "Hey, your name is Doorknob." She's actually one of the ones that needs a name. How do you not have a name yet?
She was supposed to get one very recently.
A few years ago. Well, never happened. It's, you know, it's a long story.
All right, you say you don't want just a random name. What should we know about you to give you a name?
I don't know. You got to ask me some questions. I have no knowledge of the force.
She's a PhD candidate for mathematics.
Stop, okay.
Okay, well then I will stop.
No, go ahead.
She's very, very beautiful, obviously.
What's your last name?
He also dates me.
Her name's very, very beautiful.
My last name is Krieger, which is German for warrior.
Is it kosher to see our kids up here?
It's not kosher to discuss frat names in front of people that are getting frat names, though.
But
you can come up, but we got to talk about your name. But we can't talk about your name with you sitting there.
Go away for a little bit.
And you should go away for a little bit.
All right, but I'm taking my drink.
Well, no, leave your drink here.
No,
I will take care of it.
My idea is, her German name means warrior, right?
Yes.
So I was thinking Shogun.
That's a good one.
Yes.
Let's go. Hi, Omega.
Omega, Omega, Omega.
You know, to me, it's carousing with your friends at a bar is—it's not a getting drunk or a wasted thing. It's more of a group, and it's kind of like a big, close-knit family. You know.
Hail, hail, the gang's all here. What the heck do we care now?
That piece was produced by Matt Kessler. The voices you heard were Jungala, Bread, Hoss, Hooker, Double Down, Oss, Shotgun, and Moose. Members of Pi Omega Omega can be found at Mike and Molly's in downtown Champaign approximately 365 nights a year. Well, that does it for this edition of Sidetrack. I want to thank everyone who helped the program over the last 10 years, all our contributors, essayists, everyone we interviewed, and of course you, the listener. We couldn't have done it without you. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack, all 10 years, are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.